WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
My first thought when Connaissance asked me to introduce David Halberstam was one of shame. Somebody up there knew that I'd been stealing stuff from him all semester long for my 60s course and wanted me to give at least a few words back. But when I considered for a moment, my next reaction was and remains one of intense honor. David Halberstam was described in today's Daily Pennsylvanian as one of America's foremost writers, and he is. But he's also one of the country's great, lamentably one of the country's few great heroes. Authors are probably a lot like actors and entertainers, more concerned with plugs for their new work still in the stalls than with plaudits for their old work that's two decades done by now. But fine as David Halberstam's subsequent work has been, and you can catch two examples right now, his daring book on pro basketball, The Breaks of the Game, and his devastating piece on Howard Cosell in the current issue of Playboy. His greatness, I think, is most manifest in his older work, his dazzling reportage of the war in Vietnam, beginning with his coverage of the war for the New York Times, and culminating in a couple of books, The Making of a Quagmire and The Best and the Brightest. While his fellow correspondents were covering the war from the comfort of Saigon and passing along the press releases of the passing regimes there, he was out in the countryside, in the rice paddies and the jungles and the heat, telling this country things that it didn't much want to hear, namely what was going on. I think you can measure the impact of what he did for all of us there, the irresistibility of his reportage, the power of what he found and told, by what his paper did back here. Because the New York Times entered the 60s, a mildly reactionary establishment operation, and it exited the 60s, a mildly reactionary establishment operation. On every important liberal or radical issue of the decade but one, it was conservative or worse. It was racist and actually stirred up a nasty lynch mob or two against blacks in New York during those years. It was positively phobic about students and youth and drugs and the counterculture. But against all its establishment instincts, it was right on the war in Vietnam, at least eventually. And insofar as one man could create and sustain a climate in which it could, almost had to be, able to go against its inclinations and oppose the powers it was essentially in league with, that man is Connaissance's speaker of this evening, David Halberstam.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Professor Zuckerman. With an introduction like that, I believe I'll quit right now and when I'm ahead, because it's very nice. There's sometimes a sense, if you covered the Vietnam War, the distant as it is, I mean, it's now going on to 15 years from Tet, the sense that it is gone, it never existed, it did not matter, that you are part of something that evaporates from memory. Television, I have a feeling, speeds up the process of life, and because television doesn't have time for any footage from the past, it obliterates memory, and we have less. So I'm very nice. It's very nice to come back and come here and be somewhat remembered. I'm going to talk tonight about television and contemporary politics, but I'll be delighted to respond to whatever questions you have on any subject, Vietnam or tomorrow's game between the Blazers and the Sixers here. I don't believe that Moses Malone, frankly, is going to help the Sixers as much as Quinn Buckner is going to help the Celtics, but that's your problem, I think. The second thing is, I must say, as a son of Harvard, I feel a certain shame for you having stolen the Ivy League title from us to do this after the game had actually ended, and a further indignity to fake footage, to do footage later of Penn players dressed as Harvard players roughing it seems to me an astonishing length to go to for this. Shame on you, Pennsylvania. Serious things. We have just past the annual election moment, the coming together of NBC, CBS, and ABC, not so much to inform us of our political process, but to preen themselves and, in fact, partake of the real race, which is not the race for senator or governor, but the race for rating dominance between the Peacock, ABC, and CBS. And that obviously means that we get the new Pac-Man electronic boards, we get new hairstyles of both men and women, we get millions of dollars spent interviewing the poor voters as they leave the voting booths, lest we have to wait a couple hours till the polls actually close, since the modern electronic process so clearly outstrips the democratic process, which is old, flawed, and clumsy. Why wait? Let's go out and do it. Of course, it's not as excessive, as you recall, as that moment in 1980 when there was the Carter Reagan debate, and ABC, somewhat restless and anxious to show that it was better than democracy, invited us all to vote that night. You had to pay, I think, 50 cents or a dollar. You called up on a 900 number, and I have a clear memory of sort of a vision that night of Lillian Carter's almost arthritic fingers flashing across the television telephone board trying to punch out as many votes for Jimmy as she could while Rosalind was working right behind her, and over there on the other side, Nancy punching away. The race, the almost belief that politics is too slow, and so we get that wonderful thing where the polls are sort of still practically open and we are getting calls on elections, and it's all very exciting. It's done with the newest demographics and electronics, and does it mean that they cover politics? Answer, no. I mean, we're getting all the big stars. They have people who have nothing to do with politics. I mean, there is such a thing as a political reporter, someone who goes out and covers the political process for 4 years and knows something, and the networks have some very good people. Bruce Morton of CBS is probably better than any print political reporter in the country. You don't see much of Bruce on election night because he's been so busy out covering the election. He hasn't been able to get on TV very much, which means he's not a star, and instead you're getting stars. Mike Wallace is brought in from 60 Minutes. Over on ABC, there is Barbara Walters. They never let you down on ABC. There's Barbara Walters, and she is saying, she's one of the wise men or the wise person, she is saying that money didn't really make a big difference in this election. For those of you who did pay attention to the number of incumbents who were reelected, astonishing number, or in my state where a man who had never run for anything before, probably even for the board of his local townhouse or high-rise, Lewis Lerman spent some $14 million and almost won in a bad Republican year, won the governorship of New York. It was an astonishing statement. We were getting stars, but not politics. We get a quick blip on the radar. Out in Wyoming or Montana, an unnamed senator is pronounced the winner. He comes on for 45 seconds, where we are told a little bit about him. We get to see him, his wife, the family, the concession speech of the opponent, his announcement of victory, and then he's gone, to be seen not again on national television, probably, until another 6 years when he may, in fact, be beaten. His only way of getting on television, in fact, is to do something quite outrageous or provocative, or to run for the presidency. Millions of dollars are being spent on this, but the ability to cover the political process day in and day out, to ventilate issues, to talk about what is at stake, that does not take place. There is no attention span. There is not, on the network news, the time. It is 22 minutes, or as somebody once said, the New York Times on a postage stamp. There's not the time. And on the local news, where there is in fact a great deal of time, altogether too much time, the blathering, the airheads, Ken and Barbie talking to each other, happy talk, never has the weaknesses of that almost illiterate wing of the profession been so exposed. I mean, they now hire them almost entirely on the basis of cosmetics, that is to say, what they look like, the ability to report, to think, to respond, to question something, to use the language is obviously no factor at all. You once in Philadelphia loaned us one of your local anchor men from here, Larry Kane. He came with those burning eyes to New York. In fact, he was so excited by New York that he chose to live in Philadelphia. He came every day by limo. He did promotions with those burning eyes, saying how much he loved our community. He was seen in promotions for that station eating hot dogs at Coney Island, which assured all of us that he cared about New York. And then, like so many others, he was gone. Anyway, on election night, these people who can be generally on the evening news protected against themselves, that is to say, you can get them in the format, you can have them write something and edit it down, and if not too bad, suddenly had to report live. Their almost inability to report a story, the incapacity to use the English language, which was overwhelming, seemed, if anything, to expose the emptiness that we always knew was there. Back to a more serious note, the ability of television to cover the world around us in our own politics. And what that means to a democratic society where this is now the principal means of communication, more so every day. The switch and its importance in our lives is greater every day. I was doing an article earlier this year on Charles Kuralt, and a man who I greatly esteem, probably the most civilized and indeed poetic voice of television, and he was making the argument to me that television, the network news shows, are probably now better than ever, that the people are very good and that they do a very good job. And I said, no, they are as good as they were 10 or 15 years ago, but that's not good enough, because the society's dependence upon it is greater. The role of television in our society, I mean, they will give us 5-6 hours on election night for their purposes, not ours, and then nothing the other 364 days. The need for it is greater. Therefore, that which they do, which was quite adequate and is as good as what they did 15 years ago, is no longer adequate. They have not kept up in accountability because their societal responsibility is greater. And that shows up in the way they cover important stories. There is a map that all of us here probably have in our minds of the world, and that map is probably not out of proportion to the map that exists on what Rand McNally gives us. But that is a very different map than the map that hangs in the offices of the average executive producer of a television show. Because in his mind, on that map, countries either don't exist at all, or they suddenly exist in very large shape, depending upon whether they are, at that moment, somewhat violent or turbulent or, in the cliché of the ages, war-torn. Thus, about 6 or 7 months ago, El Salvador swelled immensely on the map of the television executive producer. It became larger than Canada and Brazil, little El Salvador, and we were transfixed by El Salvador, which is as it should be, because it was potentially a repeat of the Vietnam experience. And then one day, El Salvador was gone. It was replaced by the Falkland Islands, because that was likely to be an even better war. And we had, even though we didn't get very good pictures, we had about a week of the Falkland Islands, an awful lot of footage of Margaret Thatcher, and fortunately for television, the Falklands map didn't have to last that long because it had such poor footage, and we got Beirut. And that was an ideal part of the map because it was a better war with better footage. And that leaves the question of where is El Salvador and who swallowed it up, because it is, in fact, it was important 6 months ago, and it is still important, but it is gone, not from the reality of geopolitics for this society, but for the reality television. It is just gone. Classically, and this was the ultimate media story, and it's an interesting example of the reality that exists and the reality that television can create with its immense power. What happened to Iran? We do know that there was a time, a year and a half or so, when we were transfixed by Iran. Who stole it? Where did it go? I mean, in effect, oddly enough, it is as important now as ever. The Iraqis are at war with it, so that in geopolitical terms, what happens is, in fact, even more important than that moment when the Americans were being held hostage, and yet Iran is gone. I mean, was it stolen? Who did away with it? I mean, did Les Valesa do it? Was it the Ayatollah? Was it the Iraqis? But it's one day, it's there, and then it's gone. And it's an important lesson. I think there are two stories that I'd like to sort of portray in terms of what television does and does not do with our reality. One is Iran, which was an ultimate media story. It was an ultimate television story simply not because it was that important. It was important, difficult, important story. Having your people held hostage is not pleasant, but it in no way defined what America was or what our problems were. It was a story, finally, much more about the Ayatollah. I mean, if you think about it, the fact that this man of another century with that Islamic feudal Puritanism took our people hostage and held them, that defines him to an uncommon degree and not necessarily us. But we were transfixed with it. And the reason we were transfixed by it was that television was transfixed by it. It was great pictures. You had one Ayatollah, sometimes even two. You had students picketing there and being anti-American. You had hostages. You had pictures of students roughing hostages. You had students here protesting, students there. You had families of hostages nicely and proportionately segmented throughout the country so that there was virtually a hostage family in every major television market in the country. You have the ongoing trauma. You also, by the way, and this is very important, what television does to politics. You had a president of the United States who, for a moment, deliberately, it was not just the networks who inflated the hostage story, but it was the president of the United States who did this. As he might easily have put this issue on the back burner, downplayed it, said, well, we have, in effect, a very difficult person out there, a very difficult man, we're going to work on it. Jimmy Carter, sliding in the polls, unable to deal with inflation, fearing in the fall of 79, as well he might, the rise of Edward Kennedy, decided to inflate the hostage issue and make it important. And the reason was, it made him presidential. It made him, in fact, not just presidential, but, in effect, a de facto commander-in-chief. He was too busy to debate Edward Kennedy in Iowa because he had to deal with the hostages, Khomeini. This was absorbing his time. No, he couldn't go up to Maine to debate Senator Kennedy again. There was this transcending issue. So he was deliberately inflating it in order to ward off Teddy Kennedy, and it worked. I mean, Teddy really never got a part of it his own fault, never got across the moat, was never able to really catch the people's attention. And part of it was the hostage issue. The price of that, by the way, in sort of putting yourself above Teddy Kennedy, was that the price of that was that you made, eventually, the Ayatollah your peer. You made him important, 6 or 8 months later, when Teddy is gone and you're running against Reagan, the Ayatollah is an equal. And the Ayatollah is able to, in fact, demand this attention. And it doesn't go away, so there's probably a lesson in this. Live by the tube, die by the tube. All this, anyway, is enormously good pictures. Enormously good pictures. The people you have, even finally, the reunion, the picture, the hostages are about to come down. Everybody's staked out, the families, the girlfriends on the tarmac, so you can get great final pictures of the girlfriends running across the tarmac to grab the young men coming off. I mean, it's wonderful. Even, in fact, when the 53rd hostage, Cynthia Dwyer, finally came back, CBS, her husband was off working, CBS people would take the calls for her husband coming in about what he was. Now, that is an important story, the Iran thing. But it was blown so large in our consciousness. We were transfixed by it, because it was such good pictures. And in fact, normally there is a sort of order in the media, almost a law, you could call it Halberstam's law. Print defines, television amplifies. And that is reversed, it seems to me, in the hostage issue. That is to say, the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Time and Newsweek start covering stories based on their instincts, and then about a week or two later, television puts it on CBS News. Because the hostage thing was so big, and so such good film, for the first time, really, television defined and print had to respond. Because television made it so big in the consciousness of the average citizen, print had to make it comparably as big. Now, 2 years later, you look back and you think, what was it all about? I mean, that enormous moment. Remember, they were released, and we were all supposed to feel patriotic again, and General Westmoreland walked into a couple places where he was giving speeches, and people applauded because we were all going to be patriotic again. I mean, this illusion that America's great illnesses had been dealt with because the hostages were free. I remember they were heroes. They weren't heroes, they were victims. I mean, Sergeant Lopez, who helped save a couple people, was a hero, but I mean, they were victims. And it was, I mean, all that to do, and then it's gone. No memory. And no great importance. In that year, let me give you a comparable story, which is the decline of the core American economy. Auto industry, steel industry, glass, I mean, those things. I mean, the great new challenge from Japan, the sense that those things which had made us powerful and strong for many years have virtually eroded. That, in the fall of 1980, I remember turning on the television set. And you'd hear first the news about the hostages, and then Carter, Reagan, whatever they'd said, and then one sentence from John Chancellor or Cronkite. In Detroit today, the Ford Motor Company announced its largest loss for the third quarter in history, $350 million. Boom, and then on to something else. And I mean, huge story, which may have a great deal to do with defining your economic future, what kind of a country we are, some of our social problems, whether we have a permanent underclass, whether we are able to compete in vast areas of our economy, almost without coverage, even to this day. I mean, I am a serious news consumer, and I suspect some of you are too. If you can name me 3 network reporters, 2 out of the 3 network reporters in Tokyo, great story right now, the Japanese challenge of America, I would be surprised. This is obviously an enormous story. I'm interested in it because I'm writing a little bit about it now myself, but it doesn't have pictures. I mean, economists aren't really very telegenic. I mean, maybe if Ken Galbraith punched out Milton Friedman, that would be exciting. Maybe if Lee Iacocca and a band of his men from Chrysler slipped in one night and took some of the Toyota people hostage, I mean, we'd get it on, and there would be a quick sort of hour special that night saying, you know, why did this happen, and a review of the decline. But in terms of covering day in and out, which is a great story, which is the decline of a core industrial economy, maybe the end and the entrance into the end of an industrial era and the going into a post-industrial era, the change from a blue-collar economy to a white-collar economy, the change in possibly the diminution of a middle-class society. There's an almost inability to do it or an unwillingness to do it. It is hard. It is difficult. It is not telegenic. And yet it is important. So the sense of reality of Iran is that one thing is very important, which it was not, and another thing is not important, and it is. And when I was in Vietnam, and this is not something that's really, I mean, because television is an instrument of pictures, and it is, in fact, more than normal journalism, edging towards that odd line between journalism, it's caught between a constant ongoing conflict between journalism and entertainment. There is a constant sense of, and we always had this when we were overseas, that a good story with bad film will always be beaten out by a weak story with good film. On an astonishing national level, it would seem to me that the decline of this economy and, in fact, the story in Iran are validations of this in a way that seems to me to provide serious doubt. If I were an executive producer of one of these shows, that I was, in fact, doing my job and that the job really was adequate. I think it's a very serious thing. And there's a question for this, and there are a couple of reasons. I mean, why is this happening? The television people, the head of the networks, I'm not talking about the local buffoonery, the airhead. I mean, we're just not even going to talk about that much tonight. Whatever you think, you're right. You've seen them on, you've seen them smile, you've seen the weatherman laugh, you've seen the small-time chatter. Yes, you're right. Why does this happen? The people at the network news shows are, by and large, very good people. Dan Rather could be the editor of the New York Times tomorrow, and he would be very good. Roger Mudd could be the editor of the Washington Post, and he would be very good there. Thoughtful, solid people. They are equal to their print colleagues. But there are two, it seems to me, terribly important distinctions. One is the power and the influence of film on television. It is still about film. That means that the film is about action, and therefore they like action, and they are a more volatile, higher octane instrument. And that changes the nature. They can cover revolution, but they are bored with what is more basic to our lives, which is evolution. Therefore, they tend to come in on stories almost in effect when it's too late, i.e. the story in Iran and the story to be one day in South Africa, for example. The second thing, and it's crucial, is the lack of time. 22 minutes. I mean, that is, as I said earlier, the New York Times on a postage stamp. It means it's like almost now in a presidential year, three tabloids competing with each other, hyped up, wanting the most accusatory statement that one candidate can make against another, because that will get on, that's action, whereas a thoughtful, serious, substantive statement will not make it. Fritz Mondale says that the sure way to guarantee anonymity, you want to come into a city and not be known and you're a major politician, arrive at the airport and give an hour-long substantive speech on a major crisis in American life. You will almost surely think. It is a fraction of the shorthand, the networkese, minute 15, in trimming everything down, removing issues from their context, which is really beginning, it seems to me, to have a genuinely crippling effect on our capacity to educate ourselves. I mean, they say of the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite that if it had covered Moses coming down from the mountain with the Ten Commandments, it would have gone something like this. Good evening. This is the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite. Good evening. Moses, the heralded Hebrew leader, today came down from the mountain with the Ten Commandments, the two most important of which are. Seriously. And the point of this is, I mean, we once had long before your time, very long before your time, we once had, I'm sure the history books will, document what I'm telling you is not a lie. We once had in this country a vice president of the United States named Spiro Agnew. This is a very long time ago. And one of the many disservices that Spiro Agnew did, along with Brown bagging money from construction firms while in the office of the vice president of the United States of America, among the many disservices he did is he became, for a very brief time, a media critic. He became Richard Nixon's media critic, and he would go on and attack us. And the particular disservice was that he tended to attack what was good in them and applaud what was bad in them. And in particular, he left the idea that there is a bias, which there is. But he said the bias is ideological. It is not. It is a bias in favor of film. It is a bias for events in El Salvador when it suits them, and a bias against complicated economic changes in Europe which may profoundly affect you. And I think this is a terribly important thing, and it is about, in your lifetime, it is not getting better, it may in fact be getting worse, because it is now, this is a factor of ratings. There is suddenly someone has decided money to be made in news, and therefore the pressure for ratings and driving the ratings up has gone up enormously. And ratings are in fact, by and large, it seems, produced by film. So where in fact many of the events in our lives are complicated, need to be set in context, need to be brought to us by a civilized voice which reflects some of the complexity and an odd reassurance that in fact the world was here before this particularly volatile film and maybe here afterwards. Instead, you have, it seems to me, an intensifying pressure based on film, based on action, based on movement, and that is the fact it is more intense now than ever. And I say this at a moment when, in fact, in our lives, print is already declining. We are moving in this city and many other places to monopoly ownerships, which is unhealthy. And in general, the role of print has begun and is, in fact, steadily declining in our lives. And I think that this is a bothersome thing. At the same time, we are getting, and it's beginning to seep, it used to be just in the local shows, it is seeping now, I think, more and more into the network thing, some of the new narcissism of American life, a generation of young men and women who are not terribly good at reporting, but are good at something called television. Their particular, I mean, they don't really go out and cover events, they haven't covered the country, they haven't covered the world, but they come alive when the red light is on them, and they know how to smile, and to wink, and to nod their head, and to giggle with the anchorman. And it's a kind of a localization of news, and I thought this summer, or past spring, when Charles Kuralt was replaced by a man named Bill Curtis from Chicago, that a serious line was breached. As I said, I'm a serious Kuralt fan. I think there is a kind of elegance to everything he does, a sense of historical knowledge and balance that is gained out of a 25-year career. And I have nothing against Bill Curtis, but I do have against him the winking, the smiling, the punching of a story when a story shouldn't be punched, and I have in particular against him, it seems to me, his presumption of an intimacy that exists between us which does not exist. I mean, and it seems to me that is a presumption of television, an intimacy, a winking, a smile, and we are not friends, Mr. Curtis and I resent him coming into my house and presuming that we are. Mr. Kuralt and I, in an odd way, I felt that Mr. Kuralt was a friend, and he was a friend, I thought, because he came into my home night after night after many years and behaved with enormous respect for my intelligence. He treated me like a grown-up. He treated me as someone who cared about the political process and the country. And as he treated me with respect, I came to like him very much. And he never winked at me. And so I regarded his demise as a serious setback for the values that I hold. And it seems to me that there is constantly an increase in this. We have now stars in television. There are stars. Journalists aren't stars. They're reporters. They go out and ask questions for you. And the whole machinery now makes them stars. I mean, it seems to me a terrible moment about our political process that at an annual, at the quadrennial conventions, other than a Kennedy or two, or someone who's just run for president, that the next 20 most celebrated people are journalists. And that's an inversion of the political process. It is an inversion of what the founding fathers intended. I mean, we are sitting there supposed to be a reporter. We are reporters. We are not the principal players. And when it gets like that, where the being of the messenger, because of the way it is used, because of who gets access, is turned around like that, something is wrong. And because of the star, we now have the next thing, which is the reporter or the journalist who begins to make himself or herself into an event. If there is not enough of an event to cover, you make an event. And there is some sense of this already. I mean, you see it in sports. Cosell is a classic example of a self-igniting event. He does not need the action on the field. He will, in fact, if it is missing, he will provoke of his own. He will become the event. And it's sort of funny in a way. I mean, there's Howard drilling your bank of your brain and your civility like a dentist and banging away at you. And, well, that's all right. But it is not really all right because it begins to seep into the news. And we have Barbara Walters now, and now she's sort of a journalist, and Barbara Walters does an interview, and Barbara really is as important as the person being interviewed. What will Barbara wear? What kind of hairdo? Will she like the person, or will she come out against him? And that is an event. It's a pseudo-event. We must watch in to see which way it goes. And Geraldo Rivera, will Geraldo do a death-defying event for us again? And what will Geraldo wear? When my wife and I watch 2020, we often count Geraldo's costume changes. And, you know, how many tight not since the early Paul Newman have there been so many tight t-shirts worn. And now, and I think this is an even more important increment, is the rise of what I would call Sam Donaldson. Now, Sam Donaldson's a very smart reporter, and he's a very good one. But he has learned to be provocative. And he is not just Geraldo out there running around and doing daring do, or Barbara, you know, asking the president if he does or doesn't sleep with his wife. Sam is a White House correspondent, and he's a smart one. I mean, there's nothing stupid about him. He's probably better than many of the others. But there's also a knowledge of him that when the normal process of questioning and answer doesn't quite work well enough, give it a little extra jiggle. Give it a little extra provocation. And that, it seems to me, is a bothersome of its own. You have, it seems to me, people who are beginning to learn. And if you think that there aren't a lot of young people out there today watching what Sam is doing and making notes how to out-Sam Sam. I mean, each time one of these things works, then the next person does it a little bit more and a little bit more. And it does a number of things, all this. It makes our society, our process, our political process, more volatile. It heightens it up, hypes it up. It diminishes what reporters are supposed to do best, which is to explain, to give texture. There was a marvelous moment in the old days, when in the old radio days at CBS, when there was a great team of correspondents: Murrow, Severide, Howard K. Smith, Richard Hodelet, Winston Burdett,
1945, right after the war, Morrow went up to a young interpreter on de Gaulle's staff named David Schoenbrunn and said, "What do you think of doing after the war?" And Schoenbrunn said, "Well, I think I'll go back and teach high school French in Brooklyn." And Morrow looked at him a long time and said, "How would you like the biggest classroom in the world?" And that's what we do at our best. But we're away from that. There's less explanation. There's less context. And at the same time, we are teaching our politicians some very interesting lessons. We are teaching them that if they're thoughtful and substantive, they will not get on. But if they are provocative, accusatory, or do something a little bit odd, they will get on. And pretty soon, they will become the medium. And you begin to see the change. In New York, we have a mayor named Ed Koch, and he has learned what gets on, and he has become, he's quite capable of being intelligent, but he's also quite capable of giving us the one-liner that he knows will make the evening news. And given the pull between the one-liner which gets you on and the substantive thing which doesn't, the instinct to do one-liners and to substitute that for governance, you're pulled inevitably from one to the other, and our process becomes more trivialized. We had an election in 1980 between a man whose profession was as an actor and another man who'd been a one-term governor of a small state. And the one thing that they had in common was that they were both good at something called television. And therefore, there was nobody, I think, terribly rich of texture in that election, but there were two people who in fact were creations of the new modern system. And I find all this very melancholy. I think it's a melancholy thing. I think it's worse now than it was 10 years ago. There is a growing responsibility of television, a failure. It plays a growing role in our lives all the time. I do like the second half hour of ABC at night, the Koppel show. I think that's the one positive thing in recent years, but there's generally a failure to acknowledge responsibility, which would begin, it seems to me, with an hour news show. There is the larger role, and yet, in fact, the unwillingness to accept it. And it seems to me that what they did on the election night is a reflection of the arrogance within, which is a desire. They love the large role they play. They love the ratings and the war for ratings. And yet at the same time, in the end, they'll play that. On that night, they'll give us all the modern gimmicks, millions of dollars spent on the settings and the interviewing of people as they come out of the polls. But what we really need, which is night after night, an intelligent dissection and reflection of what our process is, they don't give us at all. And that's scary. So let me use those as opening remarks, and I'll be delighted to respond to whatever questions you have on whatever subject, okay?